Well, good morning. Turn in your Bibles to Revelation. As you know, we're in Revelation. We'll be in chapter 2, looking at verses 8 and 11, 8 through 11. So Revelation 2, verses 8 through 11. Good to see you all. We'll begin with a question before we read. What are the marks of a believer? So last week we learned one of those marks. And Brother John Bastoni preached to us about the first church in this list of churches. We have seven churches, seven letters, seven churches. Here's what Jesus wants these churches to know and all churches to know, right? This is not just these historical churches, but these are written to us. So the first church was, if you remember, you've lost your first love. You need to love. A mark of a Christian is genuine, heartfelt love. The mark today is suffering. Suffering. That's what the text is about today. So that's what we're going to talk about. Suffering. So a mark of a Christian is love. A mark of a Christian is suffering. You might have put other things down. What are marks of a Christian? Well, you might have started to list things. But it's interesting that these are two things that Jesus is telling the churches, and he's telling us today through his word. These are marks of a Christian. To love, to suffer. To love God deeply. And to suffer. John Stott talks about these two in connection, which we'll keep this in mind today. Don't we suffer because we love something? So we could expand that out in simple ways. So if you think about what you suffer for your retirement, you might suffer for your sports career, you might suffer for something like work or vacation. How do you suffer for vacation? Well, I mean, you have to save money, right, to go on vacation. Unless you're Elon Musk, I guess. And then you have to suffer, right, to get there. And sometimes it's a long car ride. Doesn't the car break down when you go on vacation, right? But it's all worth it, because when you get there, everything will be fine. And you walk into the beach home or the mountain chalet, and everything's perfect, right? Or, we have to clear this out. Oh, there's fleas in the mountain chalet. We have to bomb the mountain chalet. Right, but it's all worth it, because at one point on your vacation, you're going to rest on the back porch, a cup of hot tea. Right, peppermint, chamomile tea, which calms you down. I suffered, it was difficult, car broke down, the air conditioning quit, but I'm here now, I'm resting. And I love that rest. So we could take that out to every, right, work. I love work, or I love what I do. So I get up early to get there, and it's hard work. So we suffer for what we love. And so if we love Christ truly, we will be willing to suffer as Christians. So a mark of our love, we could expand that out. Mark of our love is that we will suffer. We will suffer. We will embrace that. We will be willing, and we will surrender to the reality that a mark of a Christian is a person who suffers. So you could ask, am I suffering today? Am I suffering? Well, it depends how long the sermon is, Dave. That's the mark of my suffering. Oh, wait a second. Is that really suffering? Have Christians always suffered? So this is the point where you stop and ask in the introduction, what have other Christians done over time? Because that's important. We should stop and say, let me compare myself. Not compare myself to make myself look better, or that's not where I'm at my worth, but it's just helpful to know, right, what other Christians have done. So I thought of Elizabeth Elliot this week, and some of you may know her a lot, you know, or some of you may not know her at all, and you should. You should know Elizabeth Elliot. Her first husband was killed by spears. He was drowned. He was speared multiple times by the Huarani tribe. They were known as the Alcas at the time, in the 1950s. They were making non-aggressive contact with this tribe that had never been contacted before, giving them gifts and food, trying to just learn their language and share the gospel with them, and they were killed. And so she was a widow and a single mother, and that was difficult. That's difficult enough. And then she went back and lived for 2 years with the tribal members who killed her husband. Not just the relatives, the people that killed her husband and her friends. And she lived there for 2 years with a toddler, with a child, with an infant toddler. And there was no electricity, no running water. There was really no medicine. They had some medicine in a box, right? No doctor, no medicine. Susceptible to all kinds of diseases, jungle diseases, animals, poisonous animals. So this is a type of suffering. Her husband was murdered for Christ, and she went and served these people in uncomfortable situations for Christ. So she writes in a book that was just published posthumously after she passed away called Suffering is Never for Nothing, connection to our Wednesday study on Providence, so come Wednesday. But suffering is never for nothing. Here's a quote. And she's talking about how she knew that God was present with her at all times, even with her loss. But then she goes on to say, quote, God's presence did not change the fact of my widowhood, right? Didn't take it away. Didn't bring her dead husband back. The will of God is love, and love suffers. Love is always inextricably bound up in suffering. The deepest things I have learned in my own life have come from the deepest suffering. And out of the deepest waters and the hottest fires have come the deepest things I know about God. You probably, in your heart, know that that's true as well. Now, she's not talking about inconveniences or annoyances, like a long sermon. Or, you know, yesterday I was driving to church to finish up this sermon, and my old 2004 van, which is still going, didn't go. It died. And I jumped it twice, and it kept dying. I thought, you know, you're tempted to think, I'm suffering. Like, no, this is an inconvenience, right? This is not suffering. She's not talking about those things. She's talking about real suffering. We're not talking about our fears and foibles that lead us to make life hard for ourselves. This is a radical call to really suffer. So we could ask a couple of questions. Is this true of me? Am I ready to suffer? Is it really true that you have to suffer this much? Isn't this something that happens to people once in a while? After all, how many Elizabeth Elliots in 1950 were there, right? There's just one, right? Well, I think in our context, and as we look at this letter to the church at Smyrna, we are going to see that there is a normal call to suffer as Christians. It will look different, but it's a call to suffer. So let's look at four things. The context of the book, right? The context of the book and the place. We'll look at the call. So there's the context, the call to suffer. We're going to see the lure of compromise, the pull to compromise and avoid suffering. And then finally, we're going to look at the comforts of Christ. So the context, the call, the lure of compromise, and the comforts of Christ. So let's read Revelation 2, verses 8 through 11. Revelation 2, this is the second letter to the church in Smyrna. Verse 8, so here's what the Word of God says. And to the angel of the church in Smyrna write the words of the first and the last who died and came to life. I know your tribulation and your poverty, but you are rich. And I know the slander of those who say that they are Jews and are not, but are a synagogue of Satan. Do not fear what you are about to suffer. Behold, the devil is about to throw some of you into prison that you may be tested, and for 10 days you will have tribulation. Be faithful unto death, and I will give you the crown of life. He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. The one who conquers will not be hurt by the second death. This is the word of the Lord. So let's dig into the context. So the context of the book, John covered some of this. He set it up well. We know who the author is, right? We've been learning about the author for a long time from Brad. This is the beloved disciple. This is John, the son of Zebedee. He left his father in the ship with the hired servants and went after Jesus when Jesus called him. He left his job. So this is the person who's writing to this. And we can understand Revelation. So we know who it is. Now, Revelation is an interesting book, and we should, first of all, not be afraid of the book. So a few reminders. Revelation means unveiling. So it means unveiling. It's pulling back the veil to see what's behind it. So it's clarifying. Even if some of what is revealed isn't necessarily easy to understand, it is a revelation of things. We're understanding more, right? And what is the revelation of? It's of Jesus and by Jesus. The first verse in the book, the revelation of Jesus Christ. So it's telling us more about Jesus. Even if that's in visions and symbols, that's more about Jesus. And if I don't understand all the visions and symbols, that's still more about Jesus that I need to meditate on. And Jesus is also the one speaking to us. This is one of the most direct books in the Bible to us as people and as a church. Vernon Poitras, who's a theologian, he says, Revelation does offer a revelation of the secret things of God. But a deeper analysis shows us that very little in Revelation is completely new. It actually completes in symbolic form the message of the rest of the New Testament. So it's new, it's more, but it's not some kind of new idea. Right? So this revelation is literally true. It may not all be literal. John literally saw what he says he saw, says Vern Poitras. But what he saw was a vision. It was filled with symbols, like the beast and the seven blazing lamps. So some things we're going to see here about are like that, but they're literally true. They're real. We don't know all the ways that they're real, but everything that's revealed to us is true. But, as I said, you should relax, because chapter 2 is not where we get into all that stuff. Right? We have a pretty simple section. It's actually pretty clear. These are letters to seven churches. Seven letters. Let me say a word about that. So these churches are in this Roman province, in the Roman province of Asia, which is now modern-day Turkey. And there's just seven different churches. So these are two churches just like us. The number seven is a number of completeness, in especially Revelation. So we can gather from that, it's not just these seven churches that this truth is for. It's for all of these, it's for all churches. So this applies to us today, just like it did to Ephesus and Smyrna. And, it's seven churches. And the interesting structure of this whole chapter is simply geographical. It's like the mailman traveling around. He left Patmos where John was. John said, here you go. Here they are. And he sailed to and left the ship and arrived in the port of Ephesus, and he delivered the first letter. Right? You need to love each other more. You need to love God more deeply. And then he traveled up the road to Smyrna, and that's where we are this morning. And he says, you're going to suffer as Christians. So it's very straightforward, very simple. And yet, the last thing I'll say about the book is that these letters to the churches are nuanced. What do I mean by that? Well, these are not generic, one-size-fits-all platitudes. These are very surgical. Sometimes, don't we get on, you know, I tend to look at life and I want to make sure I just take things as they come. Or, you know, I've learned that if I work super, super hard, that's how, you know, all of life works well that way, right? We tend to have these ways of looking at life. And, you know, and by the way, hard work is great, right? So, but this is not generic platitudes. These are very specific things. So, again, I know I'm repeating myself, but it bears repeating. You can grow cold in your love for Christ. Have you done that? Is that happening to you? Is that happening to us as a church? That's the first letter. Because that can happen to our church. Maybe it's not happening to our church right now, but it might, and it could, and maybe it has. And then today, you could be daunted and fearful and timid because of persecution and tempted to compromise so you avoid that. Is that happening to you? Is it happening to our church? That will happen to our church. It could happen. It might be just around the corner. Maybe it is happening, right? We can say that about both of these things. So you see how nuanced it is? He's targeting very specific things that churches need to think about at different times in their life. We need to think about it as individuals, but our church needs to think about these things. Are we growing cold in our love? Are we avoiding suffering somehow? So there's the context of the book. Now the context of the place. And I like this little section. It'd be really quick, but just think about Smyrna. What's the original context and audience? It does apply to all churches. It applies to us just like it did to Smyrna, right? In different ways, but it applies directly to us. But just for a moment, come with me to Smyrna. It is the birthplace of Papa Smurf. Did you know that? No, it's not. Okay, sorry. He's untrustworthy. I can't trust him. People are shaking their heads. Yes, cross that out if you wrote that down. But write this down. Smyrna was beautiful. It was reborn. It was sophisticated. It was a coastal paradise. It's a coastal paradise. It's modern-day Izmir. It's the only one of the seven churches that is, this city is still in existence in the same location. There's, you know, the church, the city that was being taught, that where John was sending this letter, that's in ruins, but there's still a city right there, right? The other ones are just ruins. So that's interesting. The one experiencing suffering is still around in a strange way. It had an excellent harbor, lots of trade, a center of industry. What do I mean by reborn? Well, the king of Lydia destroyed this city, leveled it to the ground. In ancient times, when they took over or destroyed, they knew, I don't want to have any insurrections. So I'm going to burn every building. We're going to sow the field with salt. You can't cook any food. This place is dead. So it was totally dead, and then they rebuilt it 300 years later. so beautiful. This was now a model city, a modern, beautiful, shiny city, right? Like an Apple store, right? Perhaps, I don't know, right? It was this beautiful planned city, and it was this beautiful stadium. It had a library, it had the largest theater in Asia, so that's great, right? And it had a sports stadium, as I said, and all kinds of beautiful avenues. It had the Street of Gold. The Street of Gold probably was layered with gold or some kind of gold something, and it curved up around the mountain, like, and it was described as a necklace around the god. And at the bottom of the road was a temple, and at the top of the mountain at the end of the road was a temple. So, a beautiful, modern, sophisticated city. Isn't it interesting, in verse 8, Jesus says, the words of the first and the last. They had the idea that gods were at the beginning of the road and the end, and Jesus is saying, I'm at the beginning and I'm at the end. So Jesus knew, he knows obviously what the city is exactly like. And there's a temple at the top of this mountain. The mountain is called Mount Pegasus. And there was a Acropolis type temple, and it was viewed, and it was called the crown of Smyrna. And isn't it interesting that in verse 10, Jesus says, I will give you a crown of life. I'll give you a real crown. Not a stone building that's going to fade away and crumble into dust, but I'll give you a real crown at one point. So it's this beautiful place. It's the birthplace of Homer, right? So think about famous, lucrative, sophisticated. I had to take this opportunity. If you've never read Homer, you're going to hear it. You're going to hear it this morning, right? Kids, you can ask your parents, beg them to go finish reading this. This is book 11. Here's a little Homer. This is one of the most famous, this is the most famous poet in the universe, right? He came from Smyrna. Ready? Here we go. A little bit of Homer. While the sun rose and the morning grew in splendor, javelins were launched and soldiers fell on both sides equally. But at the hour, a woodsman takes his lunch in a cool grove of mountain pines when he has grown arm-weary, chopping tall timbers down, and, sick of labor, longs for refreshment. At that height of noon, Danaans calling fiercely back and forth broke the Trojan line. There you go. Kids, later this afternoon, after you read Revelation, read that, right? It's exciting. This is where Homer came from. So why am I taking time to this? This is like the United States. It's this beautiful, wonderful city. It's like Greenville. We've got a lot. We've got some cool stuff, right? We don't have Homer, but we have some cool stuff. But even in spite of that, it was a dangerous city. It was a dangerous city for Christians. Why was that? Well, a couple of reasons. It was first of all, very loyal to Rome. They sided with Rome when they fought the Carthaginians. The temple, they had a temple there built to Rome. They won a contest, beating out all these other cities to say, we're going to build a temple to the Emperor Tiberius. We got the privilege to build a temple to the Emperor Tiberius. They loved Rome. They proved their loyalty all the time. They were really connected. That was important to them. And anyone that threatened that, like a weird Christian cult, that wasn't pledging its allegiance to Christ, to the Roman Emperor, that's weird and that's dangerous, right? We don't like that. So it's a dangerous city. Of course, you know, every good gift comes from God. As Christians, you could enjoy the marvels of the harbor and the streets and the stadium and the library and the theater, right? But even in that, of course, Satan is working and it's a dangerous city. It was tolerant of compromising religious people that fit in, and we'll talk about that. That's the synagogue of Satan, right? But it persecuted true Christians, anyone who threatened the special status with Rome. And we know right after this letter was delivered, Polycarp was burned at the stake here in Smyrna. So I'll say more about that. So that's a bit about the book, a bit about the city. And you can see why John is writing to them. Christ is saying to them, I know it's difficult, but you are called to suffer. So let's look at that second point. There's the context, now the call. Let's read verses 9 and 10 again. And I know your tribulation. So Jesus is saying, I know your tribulation and your poverty, but you are rich. And this, I know the slander of those who say that they are Jews and are not, but are a synagogue of Satan. Do not fear what you are about to suffer. Behold, the devil is about to throw some of you into prison that you may be tested, and for 10 days you will have tribulation. So the first thing I want to say about this call to suffer, it's normal. It's normal. He says it's a part of following Christ. So we've already talked about if you love something, you'll be willing to suffer for it. Talked about that a bit. Think about that again. You know, what if you have a boyfriend or girlfriend or a child? If you're a parent, you know, if you have a boyfriend or girlfriend, aren't you willing to suffer for that? What do you mean suffer? Well, I mean, you can't hang out with your friends as much if you have to hang out with your boyfriend or girlfriend, right? Don't some of your friends make fun of you? They should, right? Don't they make fun of you? And you don't mind being made fun of. Why? Because I have Rachel or Bobby. I have Bobby, right? So it's normal because we love Christ. It's also normal because Jesus and Paul are giving this example. And look at, don't turn there, but Matthew 5, verses 10 and 11. Jesus is saying on the Sermon on the Mount, in the Beatitudes, getting us ready for this. Verse 10 says, "Blessed are you who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when others revile and persecute you and utter all kinds of evil against you falsely. Rejoice and be glad, for great is your reward in heaven." Right? He's saying this is going to happen when it happens. He's not saying if. He says when. Then he says, "For so they persecuted the prophets who were before you." Like this has always been something that's happened to people that really believe God's word and speak it. So Jesus is saying it's a normal thing. It happened. It's a normal part of life. Let me just read one more verse. John 15:18-20. John 15:18-20. Here he's speaking, Jesus, even more directly about this. "If the world hates you, know that it hated me before it hated you. If you were of the world would love you as its own. But because you are not of the world, but I chose you out of the world, therefore the world hates you." Remember the word said, "A servant is not greater than his master. If they persecuted me, they will also persecute you." So it's all throughout the New Testament that you will suffer. You can look up later today, 2 Corinthians 11:24-26. That's another passage about suffering. It's normal. Secondly, it's pervasive. It's pervasive. What do I mean by that? Well, look at what we have here in verse 9 and 10. "I know your poverty, your tribulation, and the slander." So that's what they're going through right now. That's the past. They've been dealing with this for a while. But then what does he say in verse 10? "Don't fear what you're about to suffer." Guess what? Suffering's coming. I know you're suffering now. You've suffered already. You're suffering now. You're going to suffer more. Guess what? Satan's getting ready to go on the warpath, and he's about to throw some of you into prison. So it's pervasive in the sense that it's now, it's in the future, it's coming, it's not going to end. Right? This is not a little blip. This is not a little blip. So it's normal. It's pervasive. And then there's two other things I want to say about suffering, that it's external and internal. External and internal. So external first. What does that mean? Well, this is where the context helps. So by external, I'm simply trying to summarize the idea that the state, the Roman Empire, the state, the people in charge, the proconsuls, right, the governors, we read about that in the New Testament. Those people are persecuting real Christians, the ruling elite, the major institutions, the libraries, the museums, the theaters, the sports stadiums, the Smyrna Fishermen's Glee Club, right? All of that, all of those, they're persecuting Christians. Why? Because Caesar was deemed to be a god. As a god, you had to worship him. You had to bow and swear allegiance to him, a loyalty oath. You had to burn incense before the flame burning in front of his temple or around the city. You had to worship him as a god. You had to declare your loyalty, your love for him, and you had to call him Lord. When you think about the New Testament, how many times Lord is used as a sign of my sovereign, my king. Right? That was dangerous. That was seditious. That was disloyal. Maybe you were treacherous. Right? Maybe you were from those Germanic tribes here to spy out the Roman Empire, right? That's what they thought. So, you know, you can imagine the average Roman. So they were persecuting Christians. They looked down on them, and the officials, the legions, they suspected Christians of all kinds of crimes against the state. And you can imagine what the Romans would have said. I mean, imagine a Roman in Smyrna, a Roman citizen in Smyrna saying, look, this is just fair and reasonable. Come on, Christians, just bow to Caesar. He's not saying he's the only God. He's saying he's just one of the gods. Can't you, right? You can have yours. He's one. Just simply say that he is one and bow to him. You guys are the ones being the weird, dangerous, toxic people who claim exclusivity. You're the ones saying there's only one God and Caesar's not a God. Right? That's what the Roman perspective, they would have rolled their eyes at the Christians. How uptight, how strict, how disloyal, maybe treacherous. So they lived this way. They lived this way. So this external affliction forced them to choose between God or acceptance in the culture or even just a job. So they had to choose, will I love Jesus and face Caesar's wrath? Or will I compromise in some fashion and say, quietly, Caesar is my Lord too? Do you love Jesus enough to lose a promotion or lose a boyfriend or lose a girlfriend? Lose something here in Greenville or United States that's valuable because you're saying, no, Christ is my Lord. I love him more than that thing, right? Why am I saying girlfriend and boyfriend? I mean, you know, we have people probably dating in this church. It's like, well, what if that girlfriend and boyfriend is leading you away from Christ, asking you to love them more than God? I mean, that's possible, right? We can use any good thing and become make it an idol, right? Is there an ideology, a philosophy, political party that will tolerate your Christianity as long as you worship first at the altar of Caesar, whatever that may be? It could be almost anything, right? We have to think about that. So the suffering was external. Suffering is external. And I think it's important that even in Greenville, United States certainly, it's becoming more evident that these external pressures will increase upon us. And it's normal. That's not a cause of alarm right? It's alarming in the sense that it's real and it's dangerous and people might die, but it's just part of a normal Christian life. You're going to suffer. There's going to be external pressure placed upon you. The other part of this is the internal part. So what do I mean by suffering is internal? This is the friendly fire, so-called friendly fire. These are the attacks from the religious people. I'll call them the faux Christians, the faux God followers, the elite progressive Christians. These people afflicted and attacked and betrayed the true followers of Christ. Look at the last part of verse 9. And the slander of those who say that they are Jews and are not, but are a synagogue of Satan. So let me unpack this. Don't think this is talking about a satanic house of worship, right? But it's certainly a group of religious people who are fueled by Satan. What does that mean? Well, let's look at this for a minute. So he says Jews, but not Jews. Well, these are, so in context, and I'll point to another verse that helps clarify this in Romans, but these are Christ-denying Jewish people. They're well-connected to the state, and they're attacking Christ-loving Jewish people. So Christ-denying Jewish people are attacking Christ-loving Jewish people. And the Christ-denying people happen to have a good connection, you know, sweetheart deal with the Roman authorities. So they want to protect that. And these Christ followers are threatening to that. So think about, you know, and this is not an anti-Semitic part of the Bible. I think that's important to say that. This is not anti-Semitism. Accounts say that anti-Semitism is on the rise in Europe, certainly has been in France for a long time, even portions of the U.S. So this is not anti-Semitic at all, and these are Jewish people by and large. And even Romans 2, let me just read Romans 2, verses 28 and 29. This is an important thing. Paul is writing, who is himself a Jew, right? And he's saying, for no one is a Jew who is outwardly, who is merely one outwardly. No one is merely one outwardly, nor is circumcision outward and physical, but a Jew is one inwardly. He goes on to talk more about that. So he's right. If you're really following God, if you're really part of the followers of God, right, you will believe his words and you will accept his son. That's partly what's going on here. So these are religious people who are in church, but they're not following their father Abraham, they're following their father Satan. Satan is a liar, he's the father of lies. We talked about that on our Providence study a bit. So these people are slandering and lying as a way of life. They're slandering and lying about the Christians in Smyrna. Right? They're God, they appear to be godly or religious, but inwardly they're not. They're following Satan. I think that's what this phrase, the synagogue of Satan, is referring to. Think of them as collaborators. They betray people they know. Collaborators in the Vichy French government during World War II. They're collaborators with the Nazi party. They're French. I'm pro-France, but I'm also collaborating with the Nazis. I'm turning people in. That's the picture you should get here of these religious people in Smyrna. So think about this. People from the tribe of Benjamin are betraying people from the tribe of Benjamin because those people love Jesus. Of course, there were also Greeks who loved Jesus as well, and they're betraying them. So why would these synagogue leaders betray their friends or people kind of like them? Well, we already answered that question. There's couple of reasons. One is they're fueled by Satan. Satan hates the church. He hates the true church, and he will use churchy people. He will use people going to church or religious people to attack the church. That's what he does. It's devious. It's evil. It's horrible that he does that, but he does. That's why it's, I say, internal attacks. I think the second reason is they loved being accepted by Rome. They were seen as normal, reasonable. They were Smyrnians, right? We're fully accepted into the Smyrna culture. They loved and treasured the special connection with the state. Now, Christianity is reasonable, right? But it's at odds with the secular worldview and the ruling ideology. So we can't leave Christ in order to try to be winsome to the culture. We have to be willing to suffer. We're living in Rome. We can't change the entire Roman Empire so we fit in. We're just going to have to follow Christ and suffer. And they were betraying these Christians in a couple of ways. So that's partly why they were doing it. They were doing it in a couple of different ways. Just to sum this up, the emperor, they were doing it one way about worship of the emperor. So here's, this is a little complicated, but follow me. The empire required worship of the emperor for real. Like go up, put the incense in the flame, bow, Caesar's God, he's great. They didn't do this, but I'm just right. That you had to do it. It wasn't just a nod. So these Jews who were not Jews, these faux Christians had worked out a deal. They said, hey, tax us per person, and we'll pay a tax instead of having to worship Caesar. So they worked out this deal. And the taxes went to support the pagan temples, right? So that's a little interesting. And what they didn't want is these Christians to mess up this deal. Because see, from Rome's perspective, these are all the same people. You all go to synagogue and church, you're just, you know, you're monotheists, you're Christians. No. They're weird Christians. We're different. We've worked out the deal, remember? And we're not like them. We have the tax thing, and we don't want them to be part of that. They're weird. You know what? In fact, I think they're killing people. I think they're working with the Carthaginians. You know what? I think, they perform human sacrifice. That's the slander. You see, what were they doing? It's the same thing you do in middle school and in high school. What do you do in middle school and high school, right? I'm told. You tear other people down to make yourself look better. Or to prove you're one in the group, you tear down the weirdos, right? Oh, yeah, look at that. He's weird. That guy's weird. Not like me. Right? We all do that. It's not just middle school and high school. We do that as well. We tear down other people to make ourselves look better, to get in with the in crowd, to save our own skin. And they were doing this to save this deal. They didn't want the Christians to have access to this exemption. They wanted them to be forced to either pray to Caesar or to be put in prison. They were pushing them out, in other words. Do you see that picture? So they were really throwing them to the wolves, right? And that's where the slander came in. And then the last thing they were doing is they were actually putting Christians to death. And this happened throughout church history. So Polycarp in AD 156, we think this is true from early church records, but this is not from the Bible, so I want to say that. But Polycarp was probably the elder of the church at Smyrna. He was likely put into this position by the Apostle John himself. Probably, we don't know that for sure, but he was an early church pastor in Smyrna, and he went into hiding from Rome, and they found him. He was betrayed, probably by these faux Christians, and they arrested him, and they brought him back to Smyrna, and they asked him to recant. And so let me just read, this is from John Stott's account of this. As they're traveling, This is from his book on Revelation, and he recounts this from early church sources. He says, "What harm can it do," this officer says, "to sacrifice to the emperor?" And Polycarp refuses. So on arrival to this place, they roughly push him out of the carriage. They brought him to the proconsul in the amphitheater, and they address him, and they say, "Respect your years, swear by the genius of Caesar." And again, "Swear, and I will release you. Revile Christ, as he's not your one Lord, Caesar is." To which Polycarp replied, "For 86 years I have served Christ, and he has done me no wrong. How can I blaspheme my king who saved me?" The proconsul persisted, "Swear by the genius of Caesar. I have wild beasts. If you will not change your mind, I will throw you to them." "Call them," Polycarp replied, "since you make light." And then the proconsul said, "Since you make light of the beasts, I will have you destroyed by fire unless you change your attitude." Angry Jews and Gentiles, and in further, if you read this further, these are the faux Christians of the synagogue of Satan. They gathered wood. They're the ones that gathered the wood for the pile, for the burning. And he stands by the stake, and he doesn't recant. And they light the fire, and it goes on to describe that the fire goes out, and he dies an agonizing death where they literally burn him alive. I mean, he's alive. They can't burn him to death, and so they have to kill him with swords. So they put Christians to death. So we have to be ready for the world system, and for false Christians to attack us. We have to be willing to suffer both from external pressures and from internal pressures. That's what this letter is saying to us. Now, there's the context, there's the call. But can you feel all, this talk of burning the stake? Can't you feel the pull of compromise? Can't you feel the lure of compromise? Let's look at that. That's our third point. You have to just for a moment feel the lure of the compromise that these people were going through. I mean, this is a real temptation. After all, first of all, the afflictions are real, right? The afflictions are real. Let me just list six afflictions. We've talked about them already mostly, but there's six different afflictions. And there's three that are pretty common to us. The last three are not as common right now to us here in Greenville, but the first three are probably. So betrayal, that's just people betraying you, selling you out. These are people you know. Secondly is job loss. Look at verse 9. "I know your tribulation." That's the general word for persecution, affliction. I know all the stuff you're going through, right? "And your poverty, but you are rich, and the slander of those who say that they are Jews and are not, but are the synagogue of Satan." So poverty, we don't think this is voluntary. In other words, they probably lost jobs or contracts, so they didn't get the license they needed. They didn't have the right connection in order to do the job, so they lost money. So they lost their job eventually, livelihood. So that's why they're poor. They're probably begging in the streets. And the third thing that's pretty, we might experience that in different ways. Or promotions you miss, or people snubbing you. And the third thing is slander. They were accused of crimes. They were lied about. They were exposed for not worshiping Caesar, and they were told them that, you know, they were called traitors. So probably these Christians were not trying to overthrow the Roman Empire. They probably weren't a secret Carthaginian, you know, aspiring. They could not worship Caesar as God. And so but the faux Christians took them and made that even sound worse and slandered them. So those are things that we may be experiencing. That's common. The last three things are less common, although we shouldn't discount them. We should be prepared. This is a letter to us. We should be willing to suffer, ready to suffer in these six ways. The fourth thing is prison. So he says, "Do not fear what you're about to suffer. The devil is about to throw some of you into prison, that you may be tested, and for 10 days you will have tribulation. Be faithful unto death." So we have prison, torture, and death as the last three. Prison, torture, and death as the last three. So certainly this is not a common thing, but we do see an increasing rise in the loss of religious liberty in the West. And as that happens, we'll just experience suffering more and more in small ways, I'm sure. And we should go back to the second point, which is the call to suffer. That's going to be normal, and it's probably in our future. It certainly is in the present in places like Nigeria. You may have read Deborah Yakubu is a Christian university student. She was stoned and beaten and burnt to death on allegations of blasphemy. Apparently some post on social media. A Muslim mob in Nigeria murdered her. Stoned, beaten, and burned her. I guess the stoning didn't work. The beating didn't work. We're going to finally burn her. Now she's dead. That just happened 4 days ago. 4 days ago in Nigeria. So for many Christians around the world, this is a present reality, even more than it is here for sure. So you can see, I mean, these false Christians who are condemned and will face condemnation, I mean, they slandered and betrayed and compromised because they didn't want to have the pain. They didn't want to lose the job. They didn't want to go through suffering. It hurts. So Christ and John rightly say they're of Satan. It's evil. We should say that. We shouldn't say it going, and I'll never do that. Because can't you feel the pull to compromise? Who wants to suffer pain? Who wants to lose your connections? What would their Roman friends think, they might have thought? They prioritize being accepted, having a comfortable life over loving Christ and speaking the truth. And like Judas, they did get something for their subservience and their betrayal. And like Judas, they got a lot more than they bargained for. They lost everything. They lost the profound, eternal comforts found only in Christ. And the comforts are our last point that we're coming to in just a moment. But in verse 10, he talks about the one who conquers will not be hurt by the second death. That is the judgment. That is the judgment which is coming for everyone. So in gaining a bit of temporary comfort, they lost everything and they went to an eternal, unending place of judgment. But they lost the comforts of Christ more than that. So, do you feel the lure of compromise, the temptation toward that? I mean, just think about ways that it affects you. You could think about ways it affects you individually and the ways it affects the church. I mean, individually, I mean, I could just take one thing. Easy target, social media, right? So, think about the lust, the immorality, the immodesty, the greed. We could go on. We could list the seven deadly sins. They're all there. We could go on and on. But think about the extremeness of this, right? Think about the extremeness of the things you're learning about reading, seeing, watching, picturing. Now, all you have to do is hit like. All you have to do is scroll and hit like. All you have to do is walk by Caesar's temple and drop some incense. It's all you have to do. Caesar's Lord, quietly. All right? That's all you have to do. I know they're not the exact same things. I know Instagram is not Caesar, but there are ways that we compromise or attempted to compromise our love for Christ. We don't let him be king. We don't honor him as king and humble ourselves before that. That happens. Reading from John Stott, again, as he talked about this exposition, here's a way that churches are tempted to compromise. So just listen to this. See if any church you know, our church, other churches, this is what our church will face. Nothing provokes the world's opposition more than the gospel of Christ, he writes. He goes on. For the church emphasizes such unpalatable doctrines as, right, ready? The gravity of human sin and guilt, the reality of God's wrath and judgment, the impossibility of self-salvation, the necessity of the cross, the freeness of eternal life, the dangers of eternal death. These truths undermine human pride and arouse human opposition. So preachers and congregants are tempted to mute them in order to avoid being persecuted. These are not popular beliefs. Christ's moral standards are also unpopular. Honesty in business, chastity before marriage, fidelity after marriage, in marriage, contentment in place of covetousness, self-control, and self-sacrifice. If the church were to maintain such standards, it would find itself where it really belongs, outside the gate and in the wilderness. But the fear of the world has ensnared us. Our tendency is to dilute the gospel and lower our standards in order to not give offense. We love the praise of humans more than we love Christ. So that certainly is our temptation. We can feel that. It's even true. If you're in business today, you probably know that coming toward you slowly in some places, maybe here, but faster in other places, from the HR department, right? Things like essentially a loyalty oath to Caesar, a diversity statement you have to sign your name to. Well, who's against diversity? I love Italian food and Greek food. It's not that kind of diversity. It's some kind of other diversity where you have to say this sin is great. That's coming. That's here. Some of you have told me that. That's why I'm mentioning it. You guys have told me that. This is what I'm facing right now. What do I do? How do I handle that? And this is not an explication about how to handle all those things. I'm just saying that's coming. Probably won't stop. So what do? We have to look to Christ as we close. We have to see the risen Christ who defeated the temptations, gives us the power to defeat the temptations to fall away. And he does it by showing us seven comforts. Seven letters, seven churches, seven comforts. Seven comforts. I counted only six ways we're persecuted and tortured. These are seven comforts. More than that. So here we go. The first one. I'm going to go right through these, and I am borrowing John Stott's structure a bit here. But the first one is, Christ is eternal. Let that comfort you. Look at verse 8. And to the angel of the church in Smyrna, write the words of the first and the last who died and came to life. So Christ is eternal. He's the first and the last. So think of it this way. He's at the beginning of the race, helping you get off, and he's at the end of the race, waiting for you, encouraging you on. He's at the bottom of the road at Mount Pegasus, and he's at the top of the road, waiting for you. He's there when you take your first breath, and before that, and he's there when you take your last. He's not going anywhere. Another way to think of this is Psalm 103, verses 15 and 17. As for man, his days are like grass, for he flourishes like a flower of the field. What's that like? Well, the wind passes over it, and it's gone. The wind of heat, right? Dries up in the summer. And its place knows it no more. But the steadfast love of the Lord is not like the grass. The steadfast love of the Lord is from everlasting to everlasting. So God's love is always there. God's always there. He's not going anywhere. Number two, he's victorious. He says in verse 8, who died and came to life. So in the cross and the resurrection, we see he defeated the greatest, the worst torture ever, the worst persecution. He overcame sin and death, and Satan, the great liar, the great slanderer, has been defeated. So he's victorious over all these things. We can rejoice. That's comforting. He's eternal. He's always there for you, and he is victorious over sin and death. Think about, I mean, Smyrna was so proud. It was destroyed and rebuilt. But you know what? Smyrna today is still basically ruins. There's a city there, a modern city, with some skyscrapers, but it's in ruins. Christ died and came back to life, and nothing's going to mess him up, right? Number three, this is so comforting. He's all-knowing. Verse 9, what is the first thing he says? I know your tribulation. He sees it. He cares. He's gone through the valley of shadow of death before us. He's been there before us. He's been there for us. He's been in the valley of the shadow of death for us. In your distress, in your persecution, in the trials you face, know that you're not alone. And that Christ understands in ways you don't understand. Number four, he's clarifying. What does this mean? Verse 9. I know your tribulation. I know how poor you are. I know your poverty, things you've lost. I know what you've lost for Christ. But you are rich. So clarifying, you know, I know you're poor, but actually you're rich. He helps you see through the fog of war. He helps you see through the lies. I know, Christian, teenager, middle-aged person, older person, you sometimes feel left out. You are sometimes left out. Let's be honest. You are sometimes left out. I want to say to you, though, that you are actually rich. You're not left out. You have not missed anything. You know, if you're tempted, young man, to look at Playboy, Sports Illustrated swimsuit issue in the library, I'm there. I got a couple magazines. You know, one's on top. It's Town and Country, and one's underneath. If you're tempted to pull one of those and put it on top and look at it, you know what? You're not missing anything because you're rich in Christ. That should comfort you. Judas didn't get ahead. Judas did not help the poor. He didn't help the poor. I'm going to help the poor. He didn't help the poor. He didn't gain anything. He didn't gain new friends. He died in a pool of his own blood. Jesus is clarifying. It's comforting to know the truth. You are rich. I know you're poor. You're rich. Number five, Christ is in control. Christ is in control. How can we get that? Because it seems odd that he goes on about all this stuff that's going to happen to us. And he says, look, do not fear what you're about to suffer. So first of all, he knows what's coming. Nothing surprises God. He's in control. Well, this is verse 10. The devil is about to throw some of you into prison that you may be tested, and for 10 days you will have tribulation. Be faithful unto death, and I will give you the crown of life. So just look, this big point is Satan is himself limited. First of all, he's only going to get some of you. He's only throwing some of you in prison, not everybody. And God's in charge of who and how many. And we could ask why. Well, that's the mystery of providence. See us Wednesday night. Okay. We're not going to solve the mystery, but we're going to talk about it. And notice it's limited. It's only for 10 days. This might be just a symbol of shortness. Could be 10 literal days. It might be a symbol of shortness, probably. It's 10 days. It's going to end at some point. It's limited. And Satan can't do anything that God doesn't let him do. So he's in control. Number six, he's purposeful. This goes right along with it, right? He's providential. Why is God allowing this? He says, Satan, the devil is about to throw some of you into prison that Satan may destroy the church. That's not what it says. That's probably what Satan wants to do. But what is the purpose that God is, God's the one behind this. God's the one in control. He has a purpose and a design that you may be tested. Be faithful unto death and I will give you the crown of life. So there's a design, there's a plan. We might not know it, we might not see it in this life. Job never saw all the reasons. But there's a design, there's a purpose. James 1:2 says, count it all joy, my brother, when you meet trials of various kinds. You know that testing of your faith produces steadfastness. There's one reason, there's a tiny unveiling of why it produces steadfastness. Let steadfastness have its full effect and be perfect and complete, lacking in nothing. I skipped something in there, but it's about perfection. It's about growing. 1 Peter 1:7, look that up today. That's about some of the reasons why God is providentially allowing, bringing this persecution about. And the last comfort is Christ is generous. What does he give? He gives a crown of life. Be faithful unto death, and I will give you a crown of life. The one who conquers will not be hurt by the second death. This crown of life is eternal life in heaven. It's more real than the top of Mount Pegasus, the crown jewel of Smyrna. And in a sense, once you've gone through this, there's no second death. There's no judgment. You don't have to fear what Christ is going to say to you on the judgment day. You know, you are his child. You've already been granted the glories of heaven. So there's no coming fear. You're invincible now. So these are the seven comforts we need to focus on as we're closing. And what do these seven comforts allow us to do? Well, they allow us to defeat compromise and suffer well because we can now face down fear. Look at that command as we close. Verse 10. He says, in the face of suffering, he says, do not fear what you are about to suffer. Now you might, if you were writing this, you might have said, it's not going to be that bad. It's okay. I'm with you. Blah, blah, blah. Right? He might have tried to minimize. What does he go on to do? He maximizes the suffering. He goes, don't fear what you're about to suffer. Behold, the devil's about to throw you into prison that you may be tested. For 10 days, you'll have tribulation, torture. Be faithful unto death. You might die. Right? He probably didn't say it with that weird face. Right? But he's saying fear lures us towards compromise, but he says don't be afraid. Why? Because of the comforts of Christ. So we obey this command by looking to Christ and believing these comforts. That's why I think he says be faithful unto death. Be faithful. That can connote loyalty, but the word faith and faithful in Greek are the same word. So the idea is I'm full of faith. I believe what you're telling me. Jesus, you're eternal. You're victorious. You know everything. You have a plan. You clarify what's really going on. You're all powerful. You are generous in your love and what's coming to me. So, in a moment we'll pray and I'll ask, do you believe these things? Are you looking to Jesus? As we think about getting ready to suffer in our lives as a church, do you believe these things? Look to Christ and his comforts and believe them.